Hudson, all the way from St. Petersburg, Florida. And she's going to talk about enslaved to the organization, now free in Christ. We understand all about that, don't we? And as a former Jehovah's Witness, Shirley experienced much heartache and abuse. I read her testimony and I cried. She trusted God's organization to help her. And now she's trusting in Jesus. Come here.
Lord bless you, Shirley. Thank you. Well, first of all, I'd like you all to bear with me. I'm not used to talking in front of a large crowd, so this is a new experience for me. Is that better? Okay. The first question that people usually ask me are, what kind of people are Jehovah's Witnesses? And how do they get involved in a cult like that? And I can say that they're like everybody in this room. They're like every one of us. They're good and faithful people who are searching for the truth, and they want to serve God. And I became a Jehovah's Witness. My mother died when I was very young, and my father was an alcoholic, and he was not able to take care of my younger sister and I. We were living in California. We were sent to live with an older brother and his wife, my sister and I was. And after 2 years, she stayed in California, and I was sent to Indiana to live with relatives there. I haven't seen my little sister since 1962. When I turned 18, the relatives get a check from the government every month for keeping you. And when I turned 18, the check stopped, and they said, you need to leave now. And I had never been on my own in my life, and in fact, when you're living in a home like that, you're never allowed to make a decision for yourself. So naturally, I was very scared. I didn't know what to do. I had a girlfriend that had graduated from high school with me, and she had married and had a little baby. And in our town in Indiana, if you didn't work for the steel mills, there wasn't a lot of opportunity there. So she offered me, would I come and share the apartment with them and share expenses? That would help myself. And so I decided that would be best thing for me to do. I didn't have any place else to go. And she had invited me to go to church with her. And I asked her what church. And she said Jehovah's Witnesses. So I started to laugh because I had even heard of Jehovah's Witnesses. So one day I was home from work, and the ladies came to have a Bible study with her. And they urged me to sit in on the study. So I thought, well, I'll listen to what they had to say. My Bible knowledge was very limited, so I was easy prey for them. First of all, they talked to me about there's no burning hell. A loving God would never send you to a place like that. How we would live on the paradise earth, and we could have a pet lion if we wanted to. We could have beautiful earth. And only the 144,000 would go to heaven. And I heard how Michael, the archangel, was born as Jesus, and that God's name was Jehovah. And I thought, this is fascinating. I had never heard anything like this before. So I went to the Kingdom Hall with her a few times. About 6 months later, I met a man. My girlfriend and her husband were getting ready to move to Ohio, and I thought, what am I going to do now? I don't have a place to go. I met a man that was much older than I am. He was a widower, and he had a 5-year-old daughter. So I married him. He needed a mother for this little girl, and I needed a home. So we moved to a town about 20 miles away, and I was expecting my first son. I didn't know anybody. I'm an 18-year-old kid raising a 5-year-old daughter and expecting my first baby. So one day there was a knock at my door. When I opened the door, it was my girlfriend with a whole slew of Jehovah's Witness women that I had never seen before, and they were giving me a surprise baby shower. And I thought, oh, these people are wonderful. You know? So that kind of suckered me in a little bit. My husband had moved us to Pennsylvania, Washington, Pennsylvania, way, way out in the country, a mile from the main road, and he would take the battery out of the car to make sure that I couldn't go anywhere. I had two little boys at this time and raising his little girl, and one day he just decided that he was going to take his little girl and give it to his former in-laws, and he took myself and my two little boys and dropped us off at a friend's house, and I never saw him again. So I was struggling to raise two boys by myself, and I met my second husband, and he was even mildly interested in the Jehovah's Witnesses, and he readily accepted my two sons, and he moved us to Florida, and we got married, and he moved us to Florida. I had my only little daughter and another baby boy, so I had four children now, and the marriage turned very, very abusive. My two older boys, he used to beat almost every day. People would say, why don't you leave? Well, when you're in an abusive situation, you don't know what to do. You're called stupid. Who would want you with four kids? Nobody will take you. And your self-worth is zero. You don't have any self-worth whatsoever. So it got to be where my motto in life was, I don't care. And when things were going on, I would just sit there and say, I don't care, because if you care, it hurts too much. In the meantime, I had gotten baptized as a Jehovah's Witness, and my second husband got baptized as a witness, too. My two older boys were getting older, and they got part-time jobs and started staying away from home a lot. When they were home, they usually got beat. I would go into the bedroom, and I would call the elders, and I would hold the phone up, and I'd say, can you hear what he's doing to us? He's threatening to kill us. And they said, you have to be submissive wife. You will win him over by being quiet. You have to show respect and let him be head of the house. I didn't know what a relationship with Jehovah meant. I didn't know Jesus. I just knew you were supposed to go to the Kingdom Hall. I didn't know what a personal relationship was. My oldest boy married a very staunchy, I'll use that word, very staunchy Jehovah's Witness woman that had been married previously and had two children, a little boy and a little girl. And my second oldest boy moved in to share an apartment with some witnesses. So that just left myself and my oldest, my daughter and my youngest little boy to live with this man. And one day in 1993, my daughter was sophomore in high school. And she got up to get ready for school, and she ran and got me, and she says, Mom, quick, sometime during the night, Dad's moved out. He had left a note. He took the TV and the VCR and anything he could possibly get. I was real sorry for my situation, but I'll tell you, it was a relief that he was gone. We had peace in our house. I continued to go to the Kingdom Hall with my two youngest children. We had an elder that lived not too far from us. A young man was married with a little girl. And the house that I had was very large, and the expenses to keep it up were very more than I could really afford. So he said, I'll tell you what, I want to take my little girl and my wife, and we want to move to North Carolina. I want to start a business there. How about renting my smaller house, and it was nice, with an option to buy for 1 year, and I'll sell you the house. So I said, well, that's fantastic. That would help me out a lot. Three times he set the date for me to move, and each time I'd get ready to move, he'd say, I'm not ready to go yet. So finally he set the date, and I got the moving trucks to come and move us out. And we got over there, and he was still in the house. I had given my house up, and he says, I'm not ready to go. And I said, now what do I do? So he said, I'll tell you what, we'll go stay with somebody else. You go ahead and move in the house, but give us part of the garage and two rooms to store our stuff until we can get it out of here. And I said, well, okay. What else are we going to do, you know? So after 2 weeks, he took all of his belongings, and he moved them out and put them in storage. I'm still paying full everything on the house. But because he put his belongings in storage, he didn't have any money to move. So he took a travel trailer and he moved into my backyard. This is an elder. he hooked up to my electric and my water, and he even ran an extension out from my telephone out to his trailer. And he used, I was paying for this man to live in my backyard. I would go to work, and he'd take our clothes out of the washer dryer, he and his wife, and put theirs in. And I would find out that during the daytime, since they're in a little travel trailer, they would come in my house and turn the air conditioner way down and watch TV. And if they wanted something out of the refrigerator, they got it. So after 2 months, I went to the elders, and I said, I can't afford to support this man anymore. And they chastised me, said that, be grateful that you can help this elder out in a time of trouble like this. So finally, the city found out he was living there, and they said, don't you know it's against the law to move, live in somebody's backyard? So thankfully, they made him move. But when the year was up, he sold the house out from under me. So now I had to find another place again, and we only had a few days, so we moved into an apartment. I began taking my kids, my daughter and my little boy, to Avon Park, Florida, which is 100 miles from our house. And they had a big horse ranch up there. And my children just loved it. They would ride the horses, and we'd have such good fun up there. The only problem was that they weren't Jehovah's Witnesses, although they were nice people, so that didn't go over very well in the congregation. In 1995, we had a very large district convention. And I had been talking to some of the single sisters in the hall, and I said, you know, there's got to be more to life than this. My life consisted of just going door to door, working, going door to door, turning in my time reports, going to 5 meetings a week. That's all that there was. And the sisters said, you know, we feel the same way, but this is against Jehovah. You can't talk like this. Just keep your eyes on the prize and keep going. So I thought, well, when this district assembly came up, I knew I wasn't going to go. I just thought, Lord, I can't go through this another day. There's more to life than this. I know there is. So my daughter at the time, now she's 17, and my little boy was 10, and she got up and got ready to go to the district assembly, and I said, I'm not going. I can't go today. Well, of course, that just devastated her. And there was an argument that broke out. She was upset, and I was upset. And she said, I said, just go. Robin, just go ahead. Get a ride and go on. Go. I'm not going. So she called one of the elders to come and pick her up and take her to the big convention center there. When she got there, she immediately looked up the rest of the elders and my two oldest boys that were there. And she said, Mom told me to leave. She told me to leave the house. So I didn't know this was going on. I expected my daughter to come home from the assembly that night. She called and she said, Mom, I'm not coming home. The elder told me that I could stay over at his house tonight. And I thought, well, give her a day or two to calm down. She's going to be okay. Day or two went by and she says, Mom, the elders want to come and talk to you. And I had such a fear of these elders. I said, no, I don't want to speak with them. Don't send them over here. I'm not talking. Day or two went by and she called and she said, I'm not coming home at all. I'm staying with the elder. And I thought, you can't do that. Well, my husband had been gone 2 years now. And we were in the process of getting a divorce. I was not fully divorced, so I didn't have complete custody of my children yet. Although they were living with me, I didn't have a court order. So despite me, he said, if you say that she has to come home and you force her, I'll say I gave her permission to stay there. So I called the elders and I said, don't you know you're breaking the law? You're harboring a runaway. And they sent a word back to me that they were laughing at me. Didn't I know that they own most of Brooklyn, New York, and they have all the lawyers that they could possibly get. And if I try to force their hand, they'll keep getting postponements. In another 9 months, my daughter would be 18 years old and I'd lose her anyway. And besides that, how would I like an HRS investigation? Well, I knew I had not done anything wrong, but I happened to work for a doctor who's head of all children's hospital. So I know what HRS, that's Health and Family Services, is like. Well, there, I know what they would do to you, and I know what witnesses could do to a family. I've seen them do it. I was so afraid that I would have to go through, and I didn't know what they would pin on me. There's a lot of witnesses and only me, so I was scared to death they were going to take my son, and that's all I had left. And I said, no, you just let her stay. That's all I have. My husband gave her permission anyway. So four elders came to my home. There was four elders and myself for a judicial committee meeting. I might add that one elder used to be a district overseer, and he was elderly now and never had children. The other three elders, and one was included, the man that had moved my daughter out of my house, they all had children that they lost. They all left the witnesses. I want to get this right, so I'm going to look at my notes. They looked at me. There was myself and these four elders. I was so defenseless. I was scared. I didn't know what they were going to pull. They looked at me and they said, "You're an unfit mother, and you utterly make us sick to our stomach. We've lost our children. They've left the witnesses. You've got three kids and the witnesses, and you're literally walking away from your kids." They told me that I was a liar and a slanderer because I had talked against the brother who had moved into my backyard. They said I associated with worldly friends, which were the friends up at the ranch. And one time I had been out in field service, and some of the sisters and I were talking, and I said, "You know, something's wrong. I don't feel Jehovah's Spirit is in this kingdom hall. I don't even know. Doesn't feel like a godly place to me." Well, somebody had reported me for saying that. So I was, on top of everything else, I was bringing discord into the kingdom hall. So I would say it was 2 hours of them sitting there telling me what a horrible, rotten person I was. And I, myself and four elders, I didn't know what to say to defend myself, so I sat there and let them say that. I had also questioned the society's teachings. Although my husband had been gone 2 years, I was in the process of divorcing a man who was in good standing in the kingdom hall, but he was only inactive. It didn't matter that he had beat my children every single day. They told me they would give me a couple of days to think about it. I could avoid being disfellowshipped. But the way I could be disfellowshipped, I had to go before the congregation and beg forgiveness. I had to promise to attend all five meetings. I had to go through Bible study counseling. I was never to see my worldly friends again, and they had been friends of ours since my children were born. All I had to do was call them on the phone in front of the elders and tell them, "I'm sorry, I'll never speak to you again." I worked for this doctor, and a lot of times, if anybody's ever worked for a medical field, sometimes I'd get out of work late and I'd have to miss a meeting. I had to promise that I would quit my job and look for another one, because by working for this doctor, I had sold my soul. Jehovah would provide for me. I would have to find another job. I also would be publicly reproved, and perhaps if I went through all of this, maybe my daughter would come home and I wouldn't have to be disfellowshipped. So I thought about it, and I called them back and I said, "Don't come to my house again. I can't go through this again. I choose to be disfellowshipped." I didn't know that I could just not send in a letter of recognition. I didn't know anything about this stuff. I just said, I'm going to be disfellowshipped. Well, I knew to be disfellowshipped would be hard. I knew, everything is so secretive in this society. I knew my children would not be allowed to talk to me about spiritual matters, and I knew other witnesses wouldn't be allowed to talk to me. But I didn't know that it was going to be as hard as it was. Immediately, my kids were all, not my youngest that stayed with me, but my other three were taught that I was spiritually dead. So they were to view me as being dead now. That I was an apostate. I was shunned in public. And when I say that, it means that in our town, we had maybe 20 congregations. It's a big town. There's a lot of congregations there. I didn't go anywhere without running into Jehovah's Witnesses. they not only didn't speak to you, people that I knew most for 20, 30 years would stand there and stare at me up and down like I was scum, and they'd whisper about you right in front of you. All of a sudden, my little boy had no friends. None of the kids were allowed to play with him anymore. We didn't have any friends, any family. We had absolutely no one. Just my little boy and myself, and my boss was the only one. And he's Jewish, so he didn't understand. He hated witnesses anyway. So we had nobody to talk to. I felt such shame and such fear, because when I would look at these people, I knew what they... These were my friends, and I knew what they were thinking of me. And I would just hang my head in shame. I couldn't ever look a witness in the eye. I was disfellowshipped. I didn't know what to do. My own children would pass me on the street and pretend they didn't know who I was. I would let my little boy, we moved in an apartment complex and it was walled in, I would let him go out in the yard to play out there. And one of the elders that was on the disfellowshipping committee had a son that had been in Bethel for many years, and he came home from Bethel, and our apartment complex was his territory. So he would come into the courtyard, and my little 10-year-old boy was out there playing, and he'd say, "You know, your mom was wrong for what she did, and you belong in the Kingdom Hall. And if you'll be out there, I'll pick you up and take you." Oh, I was scared to death. I thought, for sure, they've got my daughter. They're going to take my son now, too. And I was terrified. So I went around to some of the men who lived in the apartment complex, and I told them what was happening. So the next time that the man from Bethel came to call on somebody, my neighbors were waiting for him. And they told him to leave the property immediately if they wanted to break up families, go somewhere else, not to come here. And all around the walls, they put up signs, "No trespassing," only to keep the Jehovah's Witnesses out. And I still live in that apartment complex, and we're on a list. Jehovah's Witnesses never come to my apartment complex again. But in the meantime, I miss Jehovah. I miss God. And I couldn't pray because I was apostate. And God would not listen to my prayers. And I knew he was angry with me. And I didn't have any hope for anything. And I wasn't living my life right. And I thought, who cares? Because when Armageddon comes, I'm dying anyway. I had no hope. I couldn't go to church because that's Babylon the Great. So I didn't know what to do. And if I would even hear a prayer on TV or on the radio, I'd turn it off, because I had no right to hear anybody praying to God. I was apostate. I couldn't do that. So the only hope left for us was death. And I thought death was not so bad, because you're not going to feel pain anymore and I'm going to sleep forever. And what am I going to do? You know? And I would lay in bed at night and I would literally think of ways I could kill myself and my son, that I would have the nerve to do it. Because I couldn't leave him, and I couldn't take the pain anymore. It was horrible. And I would go in and I'd look at him and I'd think, here's a 10-year-old kid. I can't kill him. He's got a right to life. What am I going to do? And I have to honestly say that the only reason that I did not kill myself is because I knew that if I died, my ex-husband would get my little boy and raise him as Jehovah's Witness, and there was no way in the world that kid was going to be raised a witness. I was not going to allow that to happen. So we decided we're going to suffer it out. In the meantime, I met my present husband, and he worked for my friends that owned the horse ranch, and he knew nothing about God. But he watched what had happened to my family, and he was very bitter about the witnesses. So we were going to get married, and I'm still desperate. We couldn't get married in the Kingdom Hall, of course. We couldn't get married in the church. I couldn't do it. I was amiss, God. So I went to Haslam's Bookstore in St. Petersburg, where I live, and Haslam's Bookstore is the biggest bookstore in our part of Florida. It's huge. And the Lord led me there, but I did not know it was the Lord that led me there. I just had a desire to go and look up books on religion, because I miss God so much. And I started looking through the books, and every single book under cult lists Jehovah's Witnesses. And I thought, this is nuts. There's no way in the world I would ever belong to a cult. I couldn't, not me, you know. But that was there. So I looked in the back of the books, and all of them had Ed Gross's name as an authority on cults. I was so desperate. I sat down and I wrote Ed Gross a letter, and I told him everything that had happened to me. Now, I didn't know this man, and I never expected to get an answer to my letter because he's an author and, you know, a professor in California. But I thought, it makes me feel better writing it and sending it anyway. Well, about 2 weeks later, I got a phone call at 10 o'clock at night, and it was Ed Gross. I was shocked. He kept me on the phone for 2 hours talking to me and making me feel better and letting me know I didn't do anything wrong and explaining things to me, and I never had anybody tell me this stuff before. And I said, I'm so alone. And he said, you're not alone. He said, I'm going to put you in touch with people, and one of them that are close to you. One of them was Diane Golson. So Diane and I called her, and we talked for about 2 hours. And she said, I'm going to put you in touch with some friends who live closer to you. Well, it was Bill Blatz. Bill Blatz is my miracle. He lost his family when he came out of the witnesses, and he knew what I was going through. We just burned the phone lines. Bill was my lifeline. He just helped me so much. I can't tell you about Bill. And he put me also in touch with Cheryl Dixon, my friend who's an ex-witness. Well, Cheryl kept encouraging me to go to church. And there's no way I'm going into Babylon the Great, you know. But she said, Cheryl, I came out of the witnesses. I'm married to a Baptist minister. And I thought, okay, I will try it, but you've got to hold my hand all the while I'm there. So I went with my son and my husband, and Cheryl took us to, I don't know if any of you here have heard of it, Ray Brubaker's God News Behind the News. He has a program on TV. And this little chapel, and we went there, and there was so much love, and they were so patient with me. They had such a burden for witnesses. Nobody ever acted this way about me before. Well, wouldn't you know, about the second time we went, they served communion. And I thought, oh, now what? Because this is only for the 144,000. But they were very respectful. They passed me by. And after a few times, I thought, well, Lord, I'm going to try it and see. And my son, you know, he wasn't sure. But they gave us a little talk what communion was all about. And I thought, well, God struck us dead. We didn't have anything because we were going to die in Armageddon anyway. So... We tried it. Well, then, I'm going to tell you what. Somebody in this little chapel, a couple of people started talking in tongues. And I thought, oh, God, the demons are coming after us. I was so scared. Then I didn't know what to do. So then somebody fell down and they started praying over him. And I said, oh, Lord, here we go again, you know. But by this time, I had seen it all and nothing was surprising me now. So... figured it must be okay, you know. So then, one day I was at home, and on my front door, somebody had left a ticket to a free play called Heaven's Gates and Hell's Flames. And I thought, boy, this sounds pretty good. So I ran around to every door in my apartment complex, and if they weren't going to the play, could I have their ticket? I didn't know you didn't have to have a ticket to go to this play. So I called Cheryl. I said, Cheryl, I got these tickets to this play. Please go with me. I want to see what it's like. And she said, sure, I'll go with you. So she got the Brubakers and a bunch of people, and we all went to this big church just a few blocks away from me. And I'd never seen anything like this play before. I mean, I was just fascinated. Well, then they had an altar call. And something's telling me to go up. And I'm praying, don't do this to me, God, because I'm not going to get... I don't want any part of this stuff. But I kept getting this urge to go. Finally, I thought, oh, the heck with it. So I went down to the altar. And I felt this... tapping on my shoulder, and I turned around, and it was my son. We were both just crying our eyes out. And he said, "Ma, I don't know what it is, but God made me come down here too." So we were both saved that night. And in 19... In 1999, my son and my husband and I were all baptized together as a family. And Cheryl and, of course, Bill and Stephanie were right there with me all the way. A couple of things. When I got to church, you know, it was new to me. As a witness, boy, I could quote that Bible forward and backward. You said something and I could tell you where it's located, and I knew my Bible. I lost every bit of my Bible knowledge. I had to even look in the front of the book to find out where books were. But I figured, you know what? God took it all away from me. So now I'm relearning as a baby. I'm learning all over again. And I felt out of place in church. But now the longer I go, the more I'm making friends. And I'm realizing that the Holy Spirit is really, really leading me. But a couple of things that really, really stuck out in my mind that are hard to forget. When my daughter turned 18 years old, the more I learn about silent lambs, the more I question what happened between my daughter and the elder. But at any rate, when she turned 18 and she graduated from high school, the wife of the elder said she had to leave and she couldn't. She was too dependent on the elder. I had suspicions, but I don't know for sure. But they sent her back to live with her abusive dad. But by this time, she's 18, and he's not too abusive with her anymore. Besides, he liked to gloat that he had my two other sons and my daughter on his side, so he was nice to her. But she turned 20 years old, and I knew that she didn't celebrate birthdays. So I waited till about 2 or 3 days after her birthday. And I went to the florist shop and I said, "I want you to fix me the biggest bouquet of flowers. I don't care what it costs. I want the biggest, fanciest bouquet you can get." And I didn't know about silent lambs at the time, but they stuck a stuffed white lamb in the flowers for him. And the flowers were delivered to her at her father's house. My daughter was, I put a card in there and I said, "I know you don't celebrate birthdays, but I just want you to know that I didn't forget you're not a teenager anymore. And no matter what anybody tells you, I want you to know that you're always my daughter and I'm going to always love you." She got that bouquet of flowers and she was so overwhelmed. It had been 3 years I hadn't had any contact with my daughter. She got the flowers. She was so impressed that her father later told me that she took pictures of this bouquet of flowers. She was so proud of it. She called the elder's wife and said, "Guess what my mother did for me?" And they said, "You take those flowers and you get rid of them, because if you keep them, it's the same thing as having a conversation with your mother, and you will be reproved for doing that." So we had been out for the day, and I came home, and all the neighbors are looking at me, and I could tell something was wrong, but as I walked up my stairs to my apartment, the flowers were laid against my door. She would not accept them. The second thing that I remember that really sticks out in my mind was about 2 years ago, my oldest boy works for Jehovah's Witnesses, and he got sick at work, and he kept getting sicker and sicker. So they took him to a local hospital. And the CEO of this hospital is the man who's in charge of the blood committee for our district, of our, you know, the witness man who was in charge of the blood committee. My son's appendix was ready to burst, and they had to do emergency surgery. By this time, he was unconscious. So my daughter-in-law went to this man, the CEO, and she said, "We're not notifying his mother, and I don't want her at the hospital." And he said, "Since he's unconscious, I'll honor your wishes. If she finds out that her son's here, we won't allow her to see him." And I didn't know what had happened. I didn't know anything about it. He came through the surgery all right, but infection set in, and he was almost ready to die. and they had Jehovah's Witnesses in his room 24 hours a day, so that if I had found out and showed up, I would be escorted out of the hospital. He came through that okay, and they sent him home, and then I found out what had happened. But I got a word that Jehovah's Witnesses were staying at his house, and I would be arrested for trespassing if I tried to come and see him. And I just couldn't believe that my son would die, maybe, and they wouldn't even have the decency to tell me that he was in the hospital. After that, my daughter was taken to Gunnersville, Alabama, where the need was greater. An elder and his wife took her there. They were from Alabama to serve as a vacation pioneer for a couple weeks. But in the back of their mind, they introduced her to a young man up there that they thought might be a good marriage mate for her. They got to corresponding, and she came back, and she saw him the one time. They corresponded, and they decided they were good marriage mates for each other, and they became engaged. I couldn't talk to her, of course, but I was extremely upset, and I prayed and prayed, and Stephanie prayed with me, and we just prayed that this wedding would not take place because she didn't know this young fella, you know, and I didn't want her to. Hopefully, she would wake up. She wouldn't get married in a witness marriage. The lady that the elder and his wife that had moved her out of my house, she became mother of the bride, and she took my daughter to shopping for her wedding gown and arranged the wedding reception, and the hall was rented. Everything was in place, and this young boy sent my daughter a letter and said, "I don't know you that well, and I don't think we should be getting married right now." Well, Stephanie and I, you could hear her screaming all across the street. We were so happy. But this young man was a ministerial servant, and he lost his position in the Kingdom Hall for being irresponsible, for calling the wedding off. Every time he tried to date another witness girl, his mother would say, "No, I don't like her. Robin is the one that I want you to marry." So eventually, they started writing to each other again. And he came down to Florida and he visited her and he said, "I can't stand this state. If we get married, you have to come back to Alabama with me." So she accepted his ring and the wedding was back on. I was mad at God. I thought, "You answered my prayer. How could you do this to me again?" I was very, very angry. But the wedding was going to go forth. The mother of the bride, elder's wife, was the mother of the bride again. I couldn't see her. I couldn't have anything to do with it. It's probably the worst time in my life I can really ever remember. And I have to tell you, God got me through that time period because I was really literally a basket case. My only little girl was getting married. I couldn't. Somebody else was the mother of the bride. I couldn't be there. Stephanie was my strength. We would call each other two or three times a day. She would just sit and cry on the phone with me. It was the worst time of my whole life. And what made it worse is because I found out that other than the mother and the father, the rest of the groom's family and everybody else in Alabama thought Robin's mother was dead. They didn't know I existed. So it was really a horrible time. Then I found out that the four elders that disfellowshipped me were guards at the door of the Kingdom Hall. And if I had tried to come to watch my daughter get married, I would have been arrested for trespassing at a private function. And all I could think of was that all my life, all my daughter's life, when her dad was so abusive, I would pull him off of her and tell the kids to run, hide, and I would take the beatings. And now she thought she had to have a guard to protect herself from me. So it was really, I spent the day with Cheryl. Between Bill and Stephanie and Cheryl, they got me through this. It was just, it was really a very, very hard time for me. My second oldest boy, my daughter helped arrange a marriage for him in Alabama. He got married in May of this year to a girl that he had seen twice. They arranged it. The same thing. All four elders that disfellowshipped me went to Alabama for his wedding, and a lot of the witnesses were up there, and they had the guards at the door again in case I would try to show up. My daughter is living in Alabama. My daughter and my second oldest son are living in Alabama. My daughter lives on a hill up there. She's surrounded by Jehovah's Witnesses. They all own the property around there where she lives. And I found out my daughter was expecting a baby. And I thought, you know what? I might not ever get to see this baby, but that baby's going to know it's got a grandmother. So when I found out she was pregnant, I went shopping. And I bought everything for that baby that you could imagine. And every outfit that I picked for that baby, it took me probably an hour to pick. Everything had to be perfect. I had to get that baby everything. And I mailed three great big crates to my daughter. She couldn't deny that she had a grandmother out there somewhere. And I made up a picture album for the baby, and I wrote the baby a letter. And I went back three generations and made this beautiful photo album. And I wrote a letter to the baby, and I said, I may never get to see you, but you have a grandma who loves you. And I want you to know what your family looked like. And I sent her the medical history. And my daughter wrote me a letter, first time I'd heard from her in 7 years. And she said, I know that you want to be a grandmother, and I know you want to rock this baby and spoil this baby, but you're an apostate, and my conscience will never allow you to see this baby or have anything to do with it. I thought I could make it through that, but in July of this year, she had a little girl, Alexis Janine, and that was a pretty horrible time to go through, to know that the baby was there, and I wouldn't never get to see this little baby. Then, in August of this year, I got a call from the St. Petersburg Times newspaper and said, we're doing a story. We've got so many letters. People want us to print the other side of Jehovah's Witnesses. All we hear is the good side. Would you give a little two-paragraph statement what it's like to come out of the witness? So I said, well, why not? She interviewed 10 other people. Well, then they came and they interviewed me. And a few days later, the newspaper called me and they said, we've canceled everything. The only one who's going to be in this story is you and Bill Bowen from Silent Lambs. And I thought, oh, no. I said, you've got to cut most of this out. My kids are in the witnesses. I can't embarrass them. So she did cut a lot of it out. But I knew this article was coming. She told me the day it was coming. And I said, Lord, I prayed. I said, I'm calling my children. I'll know how they feel. They're either going to hang up on me and I'll never see them again, or they're going to talk to me and it'll probably be the last good conversation I ever have. Son, he had gotten married. I said, I want to meet your wife. I want to know her. And we, it was so nice. And I talked to my daughter. She never asked how I was or invited me to come, but she told me little tidbits about the baby and said, Mom, did I do this when I was a baby? And I, such a nice conversation. I couldn't reach my older son. And then the newspaper came out, and I saw this giant picture of me on the paper. It was front page. So I went to the newspaper box and I grabbed all the newspapers. I didn't want my neighbors to see this picture. But then they... Well, I bought up all the newspapers by my stand, but they put it on the internet and... I heard it was all through different papers. The elder that had taken my daughter saw the newspaper. He immediately, it was on a Thursday night, that's Thursday, it came out, this Thursday night ministry school up there. So he took the newspaper and he was waiting for my oldest son when he showed up at the Kingdom Hall. That was the wrong thing to do because, so my son was not too happy he did this. Right away he said, we've got to shut her up. We've got to do something. I've been in contact with Bethel.
My son and one of the elders said, no, don't say anything, let it go. Because she could bring out how we don't vote. She could bring out, I knew pedophiles personally. They said, we can't afford any more bad publicity. They wanted to drop it. But this elder, for about 2 to 3 weeks, he did everything he could to try to get Bethel to do something about me. But there was nothing they could do because I hadn't lied. I tried to call my son again, and he heard my voice, and he hung up. He wouldn't even accept an explanation. This was not, I wasn't supposed to happen. He wouldn't listen to me. I got a message from my ex-husband that in Alabama, the circuit overseer met with my two children and said, you know you're supposed to hate what is bad, and your mother is bad now. Not only is she an apostate, but she's gone public and become a public enemy of Jehovah's organization. So you are literally to think of her as being dead. If anybody asks you what happened to your mother, she's dead now. And even in a family emergency, you cannot notify her. She's dead. They sent notice to me to forget I ever have a granddaughter. My chances of ever seeing her are over and done with. For the first time in his life, my ex-husband called my little boy, and he's 17 now. He's still my little boy. But he was afraid of his father. He knows what his father could do. He spoke up to his dad, and he said, how dare you judge my mother this way? We don't condemn you. You can't condemn her. She spoke the truth, whether you like it or not. So he went through 2 months of shunning his father, or his father shunning him. No calls, nothing. Just within the last couple of weeks, his dad is calling him and bribing him with trips and things again. So I'm praying that he's a good Christian boy. I know he's going to be fine. It just, you know. I asked the Lord, why do you let me hurt this way? All I want to do is get out of that cult, Lord, and I want to do what you want me to do. Why do I have to be punished for doing the right thing? And I couldn't understand it. Since the article came out, I don't know how many emails and letters, people calling me on the phone and saying, we got to get out of the witnesses. Tell us how to do it. We can't lose our families. There's no way to do it. I've had a couple of people that call me and say, we don't know what to do. Our fathers are active elders in the Kingdom Hall, and they've raped us. And I'm trying to put them in touch with Silent Lambs. I know so many children, including my own step-granddaughter, that have run away from home, never to come back again, because they couldn't face the life of living as a Jehovah's Witness. I know that one boy personally that grew up with my children that committed suicide because he 18 years old, he couldn't take his family shunning him anymore. He had nobody. And so I know God's let me hurt because now I know their pain and I know what they're going through, and I can help other people. And I know God's he's going to use me because I know now why I've been going through this pain. And so I know that we have to pray for those that are still in bondage, because I know my oldest boy is miserable. I run into him twice in a grocery store, and his own wife turned him in for speaking to me, maybe for 5 seconds. And he was warned, the next time you speak to her, you will lose your entire family. He doesn't want to be a witness, but he's going to lose his family if he leaves. So there's people like that in that position. And my friend Cheryl, she wants to sing a song for you today. She writes her own songs, and she sings Christian music and ex-Jehovah's Witness. And she sings this song, and it's called He Didn't Throw the Clay Away. And I know that it gets to me because it shows me that no matter what we've been through or what our past is or what we've come through, God's not done with us yet. And he didn't throw this clay away. And Cheryl wants to sing this song for you.
in His image, He wants me to stay. But when I stumble and I fall, and my breath has so many grace, He just picks up the pieces. He doesn't throw the clay away. Over and over, He molds me and makes me into His likeness. He fashions the clay, a vessel of honor.
Wanted to say, I have I brought a couple extra copies of this newspaper. I'm going to put them on Joan's table back there. If anybody wants to look at any, they'll be there. Thank you.